good time so far.
Today is August the 24th, 2015. Give me your names.
I'm Yvonne Brown.
James Brown.
Well, welcome. I'm so thrilled to have this conversation about the history of our beloved hometown. Overtown for some, Black Bottom, and Newtown. Mr. Brown, let's begin this conversation by just talking about when you were born and and your parents.
Born 1939 in Sarasota, Florida, 2500 North Oscar Avenue. My parents, my mom moved from Ocala, Florida as a 15-year-old in 1916, and my dad came a year later from Valdosta, Georgia at age 17. So, and they built a home at 2500 North Oscar Avenue in 1928 on a lot they bought in 1926 for $450, and we still own that property.
Why did they come from Valdosta and Ocala?
It was opportunities. Both areas were basically agricultural areas. My dad's family was following the turpentine camps, and my mother came as a 15-year-old and started working in a laundry because her two old sisters were here, and then she finally moved into domestic work. And my dad came and found work in the construction industry and eventually worked in the hotels as an elevator operator and then to Bobby Jones Golf Course. So it was a move from an agricultural agrarian kind of employment to one within the city.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Mrs. Brown? What about your parents and your birth date?
Well, I was born here in Sarasota in 1938. And my grandparents moved here with 15 children in 1925. From Georgia, Quitman, Georgia, I believe it was. So I was very fortunate to have them raise me. And my father's name is Eugene Carnegie. And my mother's name is Corrine Major Vanstory. So when they came here, it's my understanding that because of housing and the like thereof, with all of the children, now they had 15 children, but I don't think they came here from Georgia with 15, because I believe three of the younger ones were born here in Sarasota. So anyway, the story goes that my grandfather had to house them, the family, in a makeshift housing situation, which was more or less like a tent. Now, of course, I wouldn't know that, and they didn't really talk about it a lot, but you know, late in the evening when everybody's gathered, you'd hear those kinds of stories. But later on, they moved to a two-story building, which was on 8th Street, later became 14th Street. I think I might have that backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was 14th Street and later became 8th Street in mm-hmm. what we call Overtown.
What kind of work did your ancestors do?
Well, my grandfather was a carpenter, and he did lots of repair work over on what was then 6th Street. And there were a lot of homes in that area, and there were a lot of roofs needing to be repaired. And he also loved to fish, but I think also that was a way of getting money for the family. He loved to snatch mullet from the bridge, and he rode his bicycle everywhere. So those were my early beginnings.
What do you remember? Tell us some stories about what you remember about growing up in that area.
Oh, it was beautiful. It was, we laugh now because all of a sudden a word called poverty popped up. So we were like, poverty? What is that? Because we felt that we had everything. We were happy, and we, at home, we always had everything we needed. I'm saying we because my friends and I, all of us, just enjoyed going to church, going to school, going to the movies sometimes. And then there was that entertainment that came about once a year. It was called Silas Green. And it was from New Orleans. And it was more of an all-colored, back in the day, It was like a play, maybe some of Tyler Perry things that mm-hmm. you see now. It was similar to that, only they came and they crafted a big tent in a community. And back in the day, it was what is now 8th Street on a corner over there, and that was a lot of fun.
So yes, you paint such a beautiful picture of this community, and I'm remembering talking with Wade Harvin, who he said some of his most beautiful and happiest memories were when he was growing up in Delson Court. You know, so I kind of want to know more about church and the church activities because that formed a lot of. It was the reason that a lot of people had a great time.
Oh, yes, because that was a lot of gatherings all the time. And when I say that, it was during the week. It wasn't like now. You know, during the week, we would have, well, of course, Sunday church. Then we'd go back to afternoon, BYPU, and then we'd have evening service. And during the week, we would have all kinds of activities at church as far as having plays. We did a lot of plays during the holidays. So, of course, in order to do that, we had to go and practice. And that was a lot of fun. And we also traveled back in the day to neighboring communities for church. And that was a big experience.
What church did you attend?
Bethlehem Baptist.
Oh, okay. So Bethlehem Baptist was in that Overtown area.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Right? Okay. Yeah. Who were some of your friends that you remember growing up with in Overtown?
Oh, there was Masri Mae Butler. We call her Nazarene Butler. And there was Shirley Jones. Her aunt, Winifred Jones, was our PE teacher. And there was Evelyn Mays. And we were like a little group. And all of us lived in the same area, but not necessarily in the same community. Overtown was broken up into several communities, of course. And right where St. Martha's old church, and they built a school there, that was another part of where members from our community live near there, across the railroad. But it was still Overtown. And pretty close to what we call Black Bottom.
You were very close to the water, the bay.
Oh, yes.
Did you go visit, see the beautiful scenery, go to the beach or what?
No, not necessarily. But we were baptized there from our church. We would go down early in the morning, and it was Hogs Creek back in the day. So that's where we were baptized from our church, Bethlehem.
Let me let Mr. Brown catch up with some childhood memories. Share with us.
I grew up, as I said, in Newtown, and right where the Police Resource Center is and Newtown Redevelopment Office, North Sarasota Redevelopment Office, that was our playground. There was a big two-story house there, the Robinsons built, with a basement, and I bet you won't find many homes in any side of town with a basement. But there were two banyan trees, which means we played in the shade all the time. From marbles to hide and go see, you call it, everything. But the beauty of it was, which I feel personally is missing today, adults let us be children, and we stayed in the child mode. As I grew older, I realized all they must have been going through with oppression and denying rights, that was never passed on to us. We were a happy generation. Mm-hmm. We didn't have toys. We made our own. You could take just an inner tube or an old tie and a stick and roll it. Something you probably ever heard of, but the syrup used to come in a can. After we emptied the can, you would pack it with dirt and put wire through it, and you pull it as a car, roller packer, as we call it. All these creative things we did, and we did them together out in the street without any knowledge of what our parents must have been going through. So we were allowed to be free, imaginative, and just to be children.
Is that your story too, Mrs. Brown?
Absolutely, absolutely.
You didn't know about all of this, the segregation and the separation and the...
No, but because just keep in mind, we were all in one community where our friends, family, we had community stores. It was a store right down the street from us. But our parents shopped down to what used to be a Margaret Ann, and they would walk down maybe the railroad track or walk down Central Avenue, and we felt no oppression. As James said, we were allowed to be children, and we did what children do, and that was to have fun. And they made sure, as far as school, whatever we needed, we had it.
So were your families more at a different level than other families, or were most families at the same level economically?
No, that would one of the things I was amazed at when fast forwarding, when I moved into an integrated setting, when the schools integrated in 1967, and I got to McIntosh Middle School, and I said to myself, "Hey, everything I saw at Booker, I'm seeing here. There are stratas of every race." So your question is, there were those who were doing very well. There were those who, in Newtown, there were those at the moderate level and those who were doing poorly. My parents owned a car. My mother did domestic work, but she drove her car to the job. We had a gas stove. We had electric lights. We had a telephone. Across the street from me, for a block, none of those houses had that. Right, so, but this is it. You're talking about a serious whooping. If you would ever make fun of those who didn't have it, you were in big trouble. That did not happen. So nobody looked down on anyone else because that was not the way it was supposed to happen. So, in answer to your question, I would say that my family definitely was in that middle tier, no doubt about it.
Was there a lot of sharing going on? And I understand it was a tight-knit community. So, you know, did you share with others that didn't have?
Yes. You know, in times of need, yes. But there was also, I understand, I heard those people who lived in the project were, you know, prone to, you have a cup of sugar, you have an egg. No, we never had that in our neighborhoods, you know. But if anybody ever needed any help for any reason, say for storms would come through and you could hear the hammers all over, if somebody needed some supplies to bolt up their windows and things like that, if they were doing some work around in the yard and needed some help. So yeah, that kind of help for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Tell me about entertainment that happened in the Overtown area. You mentioned movies sometimes.
Yes, and I said sometimes because as far as our friends that lived in Newtown, it was a Monday night movie time. And at 10 o'clock, everyone would stand on the corner of Central and 6th Street waiting for the bus because that was the time that the movies, they had to get that bus because the movie was over. And after 10 o'clock, there was no bus. So some of us could go to the movies, but I told you that my grandparents raised me, so I wasn't one of those that could go on a Monday evening, but sometimes I could go on a Saturday. And as far as church, there's always something going on at church that had us involved. So as we left Overtown and came to Newtown, I was in fourth grade, and Ms. Dorothy Smith was our first teacher. There were a lot of additional things that we could be involved in. Mr. Valentine came, and the band was developed, and so that made more interesting activities for us to do in the early grades, like starting at fourth grade, actually. So we had after-school band, and just a lot of fun.
If I can add to that, The picture in the showcase of the old, what was called the USO building, which was our first recreation center, there were activities that were going on down here on an ongoing basis, especially during the summer. But for an example, on Saturdays and sometimes during the week, the Elks would show a movie, just put a sheet up with the old projector, and probably cost a nickel or whatever to get in. And they would have popcorn and things like that. Saturday was a special day because there would be people who would drive in from Laurel and people from Johnson Camp who came to town and did this shopping, went to the movies, and just promenade up and down, which was called 33rd Street at the time. These churches were selling mullet sandwiches for 15 cents, 25 cents, things like that. It was just a gathering of people, not loitering, just walking and talking and socializing. So those things went on a regular basis.
You mentioned Johnson Camp.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about Johnson Camp.
Well, this going on Fruitville Road past the interstate where Ackerman Park is now, there's still a settlement there, and these people who live there, African Americans, basically work the cereal fields. It was right there in the middle of the cereal fields, and it was called Johnson Camp. There were homes there, one combination restaurant and adult place for, you know, vivations. But anyway, but it didn't have the other kinds of things that they would need, so they would drive in. And my sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Hattie Johnson, drove the school bus, brought the kids in from Johnson Camp to school. And there was Mrs. Owens who drove the bus from Laurel area bringing kids up. So, but it was a settlement, and my teacher, Mr. Johnson, owned her own home. That building is still there. For about 2 years ago, I was in that area, and that house is still standing. So, yeah.
Okay.
It was called Johnson Camp.
The transition from Overtown to Newtown, there are a lot of myths about why that transition happened. Why were the communities, the neighbors, the families, why did they move to Newtown from Overtown? What are your thoughts?
I think it was really a matter of opportunity. I would even say upgrade, because it had something to do with the landmass, the topography. Thousands and thousands of years ago, whatever happened, that area from 4th Street South to 10th Street North between Coconut Avenue and Lemon Avenue, which is right where the railroad track used to be, it's sand, sand, sand. You could find very few lawns in that area because it's just sand. Moving to Newtown, first of all, there's more space. You have a larger area running from 18th Street all the way down to Myrtle, north, south, east, west, from same Lemon Avenue, but it's going all the way beyond Washington Boulevard, 301. So you had more space. You had different kind of topography. In my house, we had a lawn. We had palm trees. We had a hedge. I mean, and this played out everywhere. And I know because I had to cut that lawn and that hedge, okay. But, and the houses, almost a lot of the houses, proportionally more houses were painted in Newtown than they were Overtown. So you had nicer homes, and you had what developed to be almost a self-contained neighborhood. Very little you would have to leave Newtown for. And there were no boundaries on that you had to worry about. There were still boundaries, but you weren't so close up to anyone else. So I saw it as an opportunity. And a lot of the homes Overtown were rental homes. So now you have the opportunity to be a homeowner, and you know the pride and ownership. So I see it as an upgrade. Now, somehow a myth came out about African Americans being forced out. When Newtown was developed in 1914, and as the land developers began to sell property for people to move, that went on, and if anyone can do the math, we're talking about 1914, 40 years later, yours truly moved on Fifth Street after my parents died, lived with my guardian. All the property on Fifth Street from Central Avenue down to Lemon Avenue was owned by African Americans. Fourth Street, the Elams lived there. The Thomases had still owned that half a block on Fourth Street. Mrs. Dawson was on Fifth Street. Sixth Street was the same way, Seventh Street. I don't know where this myth came from. And there's something about the graveyard that that the white residents didn't want to have to drive in for their loved ones to be buried in Rosemary. They stopped burying people, first of all. And we graduated in 1956. We had classmates that walked through that graveyard to catch the school bus. That was the most popular adult entertainment spots in Sarasota. We're right on that strip along Central Avenue, across the street from the graveyard. So I don't know where this myth came from that African Americans were forced out. My parents gladly left 6th Street and Florida Avenue and bought their own property in 1926. And that was an upgrade from that sand bed they were living on that corner.
Mm-hmm. What about utilities in Newtown?
There's the give and take of it. Now, Overtown, there were more electrical hookups and same as running water bathrooms. Most of them were on the actual back of the house, back porch, but that's okay, it was still indoors. Sarasota was, Newtown was definitely an unincorporated area. The city water and sewage came much later. We, as many others in that mid-range, we had an electric pump, so we had running water in the house. We, of course, had electric lights that were turned on in 1928. I still had a receipt for that. And so far as the sewage, we had, yes. and so far as the sewage, there was a septic tank and something called a grease trap, which caught the water from the kitchen. And so we had what was equivalent to a city sewage system, and there was someone who would clean that out if it ever got stopped up or backed up. So there was an absence of those hookups, and those came later. I do know of some wooden stoves that were burning in the neighborhood because they didn't have electricity.
I see. What about when your family moved to Newtown, Mrs. Brown?
Actually, my family didn't move to Newtown. The parents that raised me, my grandparents, we moved to Newtown as a family after we got married. When I say we, as a couple, with our family, and we moved into the Effie and Andrew Brown's home and raised our children there. So I lived Overtown until I went to college, actually. And after college and moving, coming back home, we got married, and then the two of us, as I said, raised our children in his family's home.
I see. So what were people saying about this new community, Newtown, from what you could tell?
For a lot of people, that, as he said, that was a great opportunity. My grandparents owned the home that I was raised in. So, and my aunt, Amara Carter Givens, owned her home. And my aunt and uncle, John and Marie Major, built the home here in Newtown. So they were one of the ones that were able to purchase land and build. So they enjoyed it, loved it, because it was, a great pride in ownership.
I see. Mm-hmm. So I understand you all already had the ownership feeling in Overtown. So
yes.
Why move to Newtown? You already have your own your house.
Yes.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. What about education? Where were you educated when you lived in Overtown?
We were educated at Booker, and it was about 2 minutes from my home. And as I said, in fourth grade, we came to Newtown. And that was, I don't know if you want to say a migration in the educational system, but that was the first year that we came to school in Newtown. And we all, I'll never forget that day. We all came down to what we call the wreck. And at that time, I believe that we were separating the classes. But everybody was so excited because we walked from what was going to be our new classes. And we came down to meet each other and meet the teachers. It was just a great time.
Sounds like it. Now, how did, fast forward, I suppose, to being here in at Booker, who were some of your favorite teachers?
Well, all of my teachers were my favorite teachers.
Really?
Yes. I said in fourth grade, Mrs. Dorothy Smith. In fifth grade, Miss Donella Anderson. Sixth grade, Miss Mabel King. Seventh grade, we had Miss Truitt. And then we had departmentalized education by that time, because we had Miss Poe as our math teacher. And then something magic happened. We got a typing teacher, and she drove every day from St. Petersburg, Mrs. Brown. Then we had Spanish, which was a novelty for some of us. And she also came over from St. Petersburg. So I guess you could say that back in the day, you know, most of us really loved school. I would say all of us really loved school, because that was the core of our community, the church and school and, you know, of course, home. So it was just a beautiful time. We had everything going for us, and all that we could imagine was happening, and all that our teachers imagined for us, they provided for us.
I'm feeling this. There was something about the student-teacher relationship, the fact that you can even remember them. They were unforgettable. What about you, Mr. Brown, and talking about these relationships?
Being born in February, I actually started school at age 5, and I went and started on what was called Prima, which was before first, but I went from Prima to second. Mrs. Solomon McGreen, her name was Solomon, and she married a McGreen. Case in point, we had a little play. I was the sunbeam, and I climbed the ladder. And as I climbed, my classmates were all of the plants with the petals, and they would rise up, teaching a lesson by photosynthesis and the sun and the plants. Since kindergarten, since Prima, my first year in class, I felt like somebody. I knew I was special because I got a chance to climb that ladder. Okay. That's heavy, because that doesn't always happen. I knew that, and that followed me on. Second grade, sort of. Third grade, I was in Miss Barbara Wiggins. She played the piano at Payne Chapel, where my parents attend. My mother sang in the choir with her. Her daughter, Barbara, we attended Sunday school together and all of that. She tried to teach me music lessons. Didn't work. But anyway, so that was a great relationship. I mentioned Mrs. Hattie Johnson, who sixth grade teacher, who drove the bus in. Just a great, down-to-earth, I mean, just a caring kind of lady. And she mentioned Miss Truitt already, but when I got to high school, Miss Esther Reed Daly, an English teacher, she saw something in me she would not let go. By the time I was 10th grade, both my parents had passed away. I'm wondering, where am I going, what am I going to do with my life? Boy, you are going to college. I don't want to hear it. You are going to college. I got to college, and come to find out, the people thought I really knew something. So whatever she saw, I'm not bragging, but I happen to have done well in college. Finished in the top 10% of my class.
Where'd you go?
FAMU, Florida A&M University. Finished in 4 years, no summers.
Okay.
So that was, and that was her. If she just look at me, never smile. Boy, you're going to do this. Boy, you're going to do this. Oh, what a motivator.
And I'm hearing that, too, that that educators really pushed on the kids.
Right.
Boy, you're going to college. Now, when did you see or interact with other races that were here, other white people, other white students or people that were here?
We graduated from high school in 1956. So for us, that was, that didn't happen.
You never saw white people or kids?
Oh yes. No. I mean, but we didn't go to school there or have any interaction other than, you know, you just, when you go to town. And when I say go to town, that's what I mean. Go downtown, Main Street. And I never forget, we had an Oleander ice cream shop. And when my grandmother would take me, after we did whatever little shopping we were going to do, because we had JCPenney was very popular. It was right on Main Street. So we'd go to the Oleander ice cream shop. And I never stood because we weren't allowed to sit. That never crossed our minds. We just sat. No one asked us to get up. It was right near the Seaboard
Railroad.
So we never had any, it was not a pro or con. We were just in our own neighborhood, and when we left our neighborhood, we did whatever we had to do. We weren't fearful of anything. It was long before the civil rights was even thought of. So we continued the happiness that we had when we were in our community.
You know, there was a system that was well-oiled and working well. I can only speak from a black perspective, but I do know that when you're in the presence of a white, be it an adult or a child, you never ever had eye contact. It was though you were not there. And without saying anything, the two shall never meet. And that's the way it was. And, you know, it was a way of life. So in answer to your question, there was never any attempt to try to engage in a conversation or any kind of friendly thought. And it's for the record, Brown versus School Board is supposedly ended separate but equal facilities in 1954. We were in 10th grade, and in response to your question, now I'm in 10th grade at Booker. I finished Booker. I go to FAMU. I come home and I teach school at my alma mater, Booker, for 6 years before integration took place. We had, before we left Booker, we had two white teachers and two people who, whites, who worked into the guidance department. That's as close as I came to anything regarding integration. In 13 years it took for that to happen.
Let's go into that conversation. Okay. We're there. Uh-huh. Talk about what was happening after the decision and how Sarasota finally got up to speed with the rest of the country.
As I said, the system, the thought, the mindset that these two shall not mix. So after 1954, many southern states, all the southern states, just ignored it as though it was going away, and it did not. Sarasota did not make any attempts at all to start a plan of integration. When the federal government, when the Civil Rights Acts were passed and tied the dollars into whether or not you develop a plan, then Sarasota got busy. NAACP had entered a lawsuit, for the schools to integrate in Sarasota. Mm-hmm. And it's well documented in the newspaper. Their plan, Sarasota's plan, in Nokomis, there was an all-white school and an all-black school about 2 miles apart. They had one white principal. They called that integration, a stretch. And the courts approved it. At Booker Behaven, about 29 kids who were very carefully screened entered Booker Behaven, and they did well. They called that integration. So it wasn't until the second suit came out and then the courts ordered them to develop a plan or you will lose your funding. So the plan was to close Booker High School at the end of the 67 school year, then do away with the middle school in 68 and the elementary school in 69. So that was Booker's plan.
And then the Freedom Schools.
The Freedom School came in May of 69 as a reaction, said, oh, no, enough is enough. And then there were hundreds of African American kids who stayed out of school. And with the enrollment being tied to dollars, mm-hmm. funding, then Sarasota reconsidered and decided to reopen Amaryllis Park as a concession. But it did work, and it was started by a young man who's still enrolled in Riverview High School with the help of some of the seniors enrolled in high school and the kids from New College who were teaching the classes in the Freedom School.
Do you remember his name?
James Logan.
Okay.
James Logan, yeah.
Your kids, did your kids go to attend the Freedom Schools? If so, then describe them, and if not, then why?
If I recall, I think there were 452 black kids who did not go to the Freedom School, and Jeannie and Rodney Brown were two of those. They did go. I felt both of us, educators, gone through the coursework, done the internship, whole bit, I wanted my kids taught by certified teachers. I'm in an integrated school setting, so is my wife. I was not going to stand in the way of the integration movement. If this is what it takes to integrate, then let's do it. So, answer your question, our kids went to the assigned schools.
Did you want to add anything, Mrs. Brown?
I was going to say, you mentioned, not about the integration of the schools, but you talked about us not being in touch or around white. Well, both of us worked at an early age. So I worked at what was then Moss Brothers, is now Macy's. So that was a smooth transition. There was no problem there. And earlier, when we were in high school, we also worked, and there was an M&M cafeteria. So mm-hmm. there was integration there. But after work, that was it. You know, we all got along fine on the job. You know, when you go to work, you're doing your job. So you're not socializing. I want to bring that point up because we both worked in integrated situations when we were younger, you know, before the integration actually started.
Let's talk about the success of this community. Some common themes emerge: survival, sacrifice, self-reliance, self-sufficiency, dignity, and respect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about those words and how they rang true in your way of life?
I think a lot of that was ingrained. It was taught. It was modeled. From home, school, nobody ever talked about being like the people over town, across town. We were not comparing. It's just do the very best you can with the tools that you have. Mm-hmm. Our principal would say, "You can be anything you want to." Now, he was talking at a time when segregation was rampant, but this is still, we had chapel every Friday, and that was the way he ended it.
Who always
was he? Mr. Roland W. Rogers, okay? Well, he didn't end it that way. He ended it with, "Don't forget to go to somebody's church or Sunday school at least once on Sunday." That was his mm-hmm. final mark. But he always had that encouraging statement, "Never woe unto me," which I detest. Woe, okay, all right. "I'm not looking for 40 acres and a mule. You don't owe me anything but opportunity." Mm-hmm. That's the way I got it. That's the way we got it. Mm-hmm. Now, the other generation heard something else. So that was all part of that pride. That was all part of, you know, you can do. You can do what? Whatever. Mr. R.L. Taylor left Morris Brown, Morehouse, with a bachelor's degree in business administration in the 40s. Now, what was a black man going to do in Sarasota with a bachelor's degree in business? But he became director of the youth center. He still had a job. You know what I'm talking about? So these are the things I'm talking about. That, and you could see it. You could see people were, there were black men, businessmen, who wore dress pants every day up and down 33rd Street. They were proud of their business. The storekeepers had on their white uniforms. I mean, the ladies who, beauticians.
Yes.
White uniforms all the way. That was that. This is what we saw. So it wasn't a dad or dude. No. So from that, we were encouraged, and we could see vestiges of people who were being successful. So that was way. That was what was happening, and that's the way we grew up.
And the other thing is, there were great expectations from all of us. Everywhere we went, we were surrounded by what was expected. There were no questions. There were only answers and showing what we were expected to do. And it's very interesting that you noticed that, because everywhere we went, it wasn't that you have to do this or you have to do that. We knew what we were supposed to do, and we did it. And we cared about each other. That's another thing. And we cared for each other. So I think in our communities, and I'm saying Overtown and Newtown, because once we had after school activities, we did spend time until our family members picked us up or we got together and we walked down the railroad track back to Overtown. We were all together. So if there was a need and it was known, the need was met, and that is how we function in our communities.
How did you meet each other?
Well, when they came over with fourth grade, there was the fourth grade classroom, one building with two classrooms. Mm-hmm. I had this seasoned teacher, Mrs. Arabia Benton Johnson, who was a student of Mrs. Emma Booker. Yes, mm-hmm. She taught my older brothers, so I'm sure my mother had something to do with my placement into that room, I'm sure. And she was across the hall, so I knew of her. And she ran with the fast crowd, but I was the other guy. But anyway, no, seriously. So there were always two sections of our grade. Mm-hmm. And right along, we were never really in class together until we got to the high school.
And then what?
Well, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that one out. But we became friends. And
one day, did you say, hi, can I be your friend? Can I carry your books home from school?
No, I don't know. I really don't know. But it was just, I don't know. I guess we just started talking, and I went away to... I guess that wasn't when I went off to Michigan to work that we started writing. But anyway,
yeah, it was Michigan.
Yeah. So it just she was there, I was there, we talked and things. So because it's small, you can't escape each other. So
you know, living in communities where your families know families, and it continues. You know, your church family, it. And then they're the beauticians, and they're the store owners, and everybody's in the same places a lot of the time. Because as we said, we had everything we thought we needed in our community. So when we had the opportunity for going outside, like to the grocery stores or whatever, you know, you would see families there, and a lot of us were at the same places at the same time. So it was a not unusual that you would develop relationships beyond school.
I see. Quincy Hall, gotta pay homage to Mrs. Hall. She was one of my favorite teachers, and she was your cousin.
Yes, first cousin. Her mother and my mother were sisters. Her mother was the oldest of the group of the family, and my mother was the youngest. So there was quite a difference in my age and Quest's age. But she was always Questy around the house, but she was Mrs. Hall at school. She taught my older brother also, who's 7 years older than I am. Yeah.
She told me that she was mentored by Emma E. Booker.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. One of those that the high school's the first graduating class was 1935, and she was not one of that group. Mrs. McElroy and Mrs. Riley, who both finished their careers teaching, were part of that group. But Quest was one of those who had, like, as same as Mrs. Hayes, who had to finish what was equivalent to like middle school, and then go on to either Edward Waters or Florida A&M University, where they were actually finishing their high school and starting into college. And some of them actually started to teach. Most of them started to teach before they even had their degree.
Was that some sort of policy or federal law or something that black kids could only be educated to the eighth grade?
Not federal law. It's more of custom and usage kind of thing. And I know I'm looking and smiling because I know it's hard for you to understand that white America didn't think there was any need for an African American to have a college degree. You know, if you can read and write, that's a plus. So if you got up to middle school, it was time to go to work.
Wow. Being at, working at Albany State, Albany had, before it became Albany State University, it was one of those schools that black kids would come to, say, at ninth grade and finish out their high school years.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Now, some of the Tampa, West Palm Beach, some of those schools, bigger cities like that, they had high schools, but an era like this would not.
Anything that you would like to add? Oh, I know, notable families that you want to mention. We know that these tapes are going to be around for God only knows how long, so mention some of the notable families that were in Overtown and Newtown that we should not forget.
I can start with Reverend Elam. His wife, Mrs. Elam, was a beautician. And of course, I'm moving from south up north. So the next street was Miss Jensen Davis, and down that street were families that were related to Fannie MacDougall, and also in earlier years, Mrs. Barbara Wiggins, the Wiggins family lived there. And there was a family that came, I believe it came here from Georgia. It was the Niblack, Lucille Niblack's family. And moving on we had the Reddins and Underwoods. There were lots of families. I'm just moving on because there were
go back
sections.
And pick up the Thomases on 4th Street.
The Thomases, and on 4th Street. Mm-hmm. And then on 5th Street, there were the Carters, the Mays family. There were, I can't think of Minnie's grandparents. But anyway, moving on, we had Mrs. Roberts, Melvin, and Mrs. Roberts. Then there were the Majors again. Lawrence Major, we call him Pop, and they had a family there, and there was, oh gosh, putting me on the spot here.
Oh, that's okay, because others are and we'll come up with a good list, because I'm asking others the same question.
Yes.
It's okay.
And then the Esau's, oh boy, it's just, I can't think beyond that.
This is good. One more question, I'll let you go. What are we to do today? Tavis Smiley wrote a book, What Do We Do Now? What does this community do now to go into the future?
I think it seems simplistic, but I think we go right back to our roots. I think that from whence we came in difficult times, but we were in the struggle and we stayed in the struggle. I see us now as a race not feeling the struggle as much, so there is no urgency to do anything, and that's troublesome. That is troublesome. I started to work at age 13, paying Social Security. It bothers me that people will not work hard to get from point A to B to C. You got to start somewhere. So I see us living more in complacency and looking for something. I don't want to call it divine intervention, but I don't know what they expect to happen. It all starts with hard work. You got to work to get to that point. You can't start at the top and work down. And I don't have time to tell you all the jobs that I did out in the hot sun. Anytime, every time.
Tell me.
To get to the college.
Tell me some of those jobs.
Construction work for $1.25 an hour. Road construction, paving, laying pipe, digging with a shovel all day. These are the things I did. Then I finally got sense enough to move inside and waited tables at Morrison Cafeteria and Driftwood and M&M Cafeteria. Mm-hmm. I always worked. I would get home from school, and the next day, if it wasn't Sunday, I was up on the corner trying to catch what we call a hustle. Whoever comes by wanting to hire somebody for the day, I'm gone, working my way through college. See, this is what I'm talking about. So I see this thing. The struggle is no longer there. We use it over and over again, and I believe it. The struggle builds character. So that's where we got to go.
I also feel that we have to try harder in the educational arena. We have to make sure that we get our children prepared for their first day of preschool. As parents, grandparents, relatives, we've got to make sure we get our children in an educational system of some sort at a very early age. We had Head Start for a long time, and in most of our communities, we still have something that is akin to Head Start. So those of us that love working with children and families, we've got to reach out a little more and make sure that we are establishing that pride in being whoever they are. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's not enough for us to get it. We've got to try to help the others get it. And I think when we look at ourselves as a race, we've always had that pride. We've always had that love for community, love for each other. So I think when we work a little harder and try not to be too afraid of all the things that we see on TV and the looks that you might get when you want to help someone, try to look beyond that and just quietly go and see if there's something you can do, because there's a lot of people that need a lot of help, and we see them every day. So I don't know how we do that, but I think if we try a little harder, we might be able to figure it out.
Okay. Passing shot. I know we got to go. But knowing what my generation came through, knowing the opportunities that my parents missed, I feel obligated, moved, driven, mm-hmm. to walk through every door that they could not. But I'm prepared to walk through that door. I'm not asking for anything. I'm paying my way, and I've earned the right to be there.
Wow. Yay. Yeah. You both ended your careers. You're both retired now.
Yes.
Give me your title before you retired.
Preschool coordinator.
For Sarasota County Schools. Mm-hmm.
Associate Dean of Educational Services, State College of Florida.
Anything you'd like to add?
It's been great. I'd like to say that we've been retired now for, I'm 11 years, and you are how many years?
16.
And we're still working in the community.
and enjoying it, because the next person you interview is a former student of mine and ace pitcher on my baseball team at Booker High School.
And he's also a product of the Overtown.
That's what I love. That's what I love.
Great. That's what it's all about.
Here we go.
Each
all right.
Each one.
Thank you.
All righty. Okay.
Woo.
All right.
Yay. Yay.
Now, I vote. I vote. I vote. I vote.